from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, in a report that was released this week, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change said it will take very ambitious efforts, a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by up to 70% by the year 2050, to keep climate change at acceptable levels. And the dire predictions have some asking whether it's time to think about geoengineering. That's an attempt to use large-scale, high-tech methods to cool the planet. These ideas have included launching giant mirrors into space or fertilizing the oceans with iron to stimulate phytoplankton growth. We'll brief you on the newest addition to the IPCC report, and we'll take up the question of geoengineering. And that's all next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. On Sunday, the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change warned that governments are not adequately responding to the kind of necessary action that would avoid profound climate changes in decades ahead, but additionally pointed out that there is still time to avert the worst scenarios if there is the political will. It will take, according to the report, 70% reduction of greenhouse gases by the year 2050 for climate change to be maintained at tolerable levels. But what about controversial geoengineering and the use of high tech to cool the warming planet and the deployment of such techniques as high-altitude aerosol drops to reflect back sunlight and counter-warming effects of the carbon-heavy atmosphere or fertilization of the ocean to stimulate phytoplankton to grow and ultimately sink and take carbon dioxide with it? This opening forum hour, we want to key in on the recent new addition to the IPCC report and the potential value and risks of geoengineering. Joining us in studio is our own Craig Miller. He's science editor for KQED. Welcome, Craig.
Morning.
Morning to you. Morning also to Ken Caldera, who is a climate scientist with the Carnegie Institution for Sciences Department of Global Ecology at Stanford. Welcome, Ken Caldera.
Good morning.
And we'll also say good morning to David Winnikoff, who is associate professor of bioethics and society with the Department of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management at UC Berkeley. Welcome, David Winnikoff.
Good morning.
Good morning to all of you. And Craig, I want to begin with you. Greenhouse emissions are rising, according to this report, faster than ever before, and there's foot dragging. But give us, if you could, kind of a thumbnail sketch about what the report says beyond that.
That was a pretty good headline right there that you just put on it. But yeah, this is the latest in a series of reports that the IPCC is putting out. This one by about 235 authors from 58 countries. This is kind of the what do we do about it piece, or the what can we do about it with the time we have remaining. So the problem, and this is right from the report, is that, as you point out, greenhouse gas emissions are going up, not down, worldwide. In fact, during the first decade of this century, they grew about double the rate of the 30 years before 2000. Could have been worse. In the first years of the new millennium, the world has become more efficient in its use of energy, but it hasn't been enough to offset more people essentially burning more coal. So what do we do to draw this line in the sand to avoid the worst consequences of climate change? We have to keep carbon, greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide, and similar emissions down to a certain level in the atmosphere. We're at about 400 parts per million right now. Some say we have to get down to about 350, hence the name 350.org for Bill McKibben's climate change activist group. But the UN climate science guys say we can envision scenarios where we could go to 450, even 500 parts per million and still hold the line, but it would require not just putting less carbon into the atmosphere, but actively sucking it out using technologies that we don't quite have yet. And a, quote, fundamental transformation of the energy supply. That means tripling or quadrupling the amount of renewables in the mix. That's a big job.
Well, it is a big job. And aside from renewable energy and maybe things like stricter building codes or efficiency standards for vehicles, geoengineering looms as a real possibility. But there's not much in this report about geoengineering.
There's barely a mention. In a previous report, they did talk about it, but only in the most vague terms, saying that there's limited evidence, that insufficient knowledge as to how well it would work. The sense I get, and I'd love to hear Ken and David chime in on this, the sense I get over the last year or so is that people are sort of gradually, if you'll pardon the expression, warming up to the idea of geoengineering, at least talking about it, because I think there's a growing sense that it may be the only way out of this.
They may be talking about it, but the fear is, and this fear has been implicit all along, that if it becomes likely or if it becomes in many people's minds a solution, they'll slack off on the other areas that need to be taken more action in.
There are multiple problems with it, and I'm sure, you know, our other guests will elucidate some of those. One of them, of course, is it is rife with the risk of unintended consequences.
But particularly losing the incentive to cut emissions, I would say.
Yeah, well, that's one of them. I mean, that would – a lot of people fear that absolutely if somebody comes up with technology that purports to be our way out, then we won't worry about cutting emissions. And if that happens, then we're not going to solve other problems like the growing acidification of the oceans. You know, geoengineering doesn't do anything about that.
Well, we'll hear from our two academics here in a moment, but I'd like to get you on record about what's happening in California, because California's been ahead of the game in many respects, but there was a new report that was just put out that said this target of emissions is, again, by 2050. Maybe it ain't going to happen.
We have a couple of targets. California, it turns out California's a pretty good barometer for, I guess you would say, the doability of all of this, because we seem to be on track to meet the 2020 targets. But this big 2050 target, which requires an 80% reduction in emissions, there's interesting work that has come out of Lawrence Berkeley Lab, as a matter of fact, about this, where they've actually tried to run the numbers on this, and calculating what it would actually take to meet those goals would require, for example, almost every car on the road, virtually every car on the road and truck on the road in California to be zero emissions vehicles by 2050. Huge, enormous, rolling rock uphill type tasks like that in front of us. And I think the question is, if it's that tough for California to get there, what about the rest of the world, most of which is doing far less?
And Craig Miller is KQED's science editor. Ken Caldera is a climate scientist with the Carnegie Institution for Sciences Department of Global Ecology at Stanford. As I read this executive summary, Ken, I couldn't help just realizing that they're talking about need to spend more money as a kind of insurance or prophylactic, but saying that it's affordable.
Most economists think that it will cost several percent of our gross domestic product to transform our energy system into one that doesn't rely on using the sky as a waste dump. And that's, you know, maybe a quarter of what we're spending on the military or a tenth of what we're spending on healthcare. So it's a huge amount of money, but it's of the scale of investments that we make in other areas. It's just that the American public hasn't demanded of their politicians that they do something serious about this problem.
Well, something serious can be done, presumably, with geoengineering. I mean, there are computer models, and I guess there's a big difference between moving ahead with research as opposed to deploying what may have now, isn't there?
There's a kind of spectrum between researching the environmental consequences of what would happen if we did or if society did one of these schemes versus how would you actually go about doing it? Would you build the hardware? But I think in this conversation, it's important to distinguish two very different types of things. That there are some of these ideas.
You've got a big basket full of these things, really.
Yeah, but some of them are relatively non-controversial. I mean, for example, we can think of planting trees or restoring forests draws carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and few people would be opposed to planting trees. At the other side of the spectrum, there's putting aerosols, tiny little particles, in the stratosphere to reflect sunlight, and that makes most people justifiably nervous.
Fighting pollution by creating more pollution. David Winnikoff, let's get some thoughts from you on this. I mean, Al Gore called the research utterly insane and delusional to consider. I think he was talking about things like aerosol that Ken just mentioned, but we could move ahead actually now, couldn't we?
Well, there's no doubt that this kind of research is of great concern, and if you're not concerned, you need to wake up. On the other hand, I think we're at a time when we've systematically failed to take action, and looking ahead, it's hard to be optimistic that we'll reach the targets that we need to reach. So I think there has been a bit of a turn towards at least exploring the possibility of doing some of these kinds of research that maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago would have seemed completely zany and sci-fi and all of that. And now they seem maybe like they should be a small piece of a rational research program.
Well, let's talk about some of them. Actually, I think you prefer climate remediation, don't you, to geoengineering?
Well, there's a lot of talk about what this should be called. In some reports that have been part of, like the Bipartisan Policy Center report, they talk about climate remediation. In other reports, geoengineering. I'm not sure the terminology matters that much. I think the idea is that there's a group of potential interventions that we haven't really been thinking about seriously before that we need to think about, and that there is a danger in grouping them all together, as Ken mentioned. I think some are of much greater potential concern than others, and so and some we might even be doing already. So like white painting roofs white, for instance, is a way of reflecting greater sunlight. In a sense, it could be considered a geoengineering technology in that sense. And the Greeks have figured that out for a long time. If you look at their cities, they're all full of whitewashed buildings. It lowers the heat of the city. On the other hand, some of these other techniques, like putting the dust in the stratosphere, really does look like a sort of a piece of mythology of hubris, and raises greater concerns.
But it's tinkering too. I mean, a lot of people are concerned. Just that's always the verb you hear, isn't it? We're tinkering with nature, and maybe the consequences are what we might not know or what we might not be able to foresee with a periscope around the corner. What we're talking about, as I said in the billboard, such things as fertilizing the oceans with iron to stimulate phytoplankton growth, and giant mirrors into space. It's a whole range, like Ken said, a whole spectrum of stuff here. Yeah,
it is a whole spectrum. But I think some of these techniques are actually in much closer reach than others, and so I think it behooves us in a conversation to actually identify some of the techniques that are being talked about as being worthy of research right now. The things like space mirrors are way far in the future. No one's really talking about doing research on that sort of thing.
What about what you call solar radiation management? I mean, that's a real viable thing, isn't it?
Well, I think that's one of the technologies where we very much should be having the conversation, because it's what's known as a high leverage approach, which means it wouldn't necessarily take as much time and money as you'd think to have a demonstrable effect on the global temperature.
But what about the idea, Ken Caldera, that none of this is a substitute for climate mitigation or climate adaptation?
I do, speaking to various groups, including climate science deniers. And so when I show them the climate model results showing that if society put aerosols in the stratosphere, that it would cool the climate and offset a lot of the effects of carbon dioxide emissions, that you know, they look at that as, oh, this is a way out of reducing emissions and we can just go on with our economy. But if you start thinking about it, you think, well, what's the end game of that situation, that the greenhouse gases slowly or rapidly accumulate in the atmosphere and you're spraying ever more aerosols in the stratosphere and eventually you end up with a planet with high greenhouse gas concentrations with this thick layer in the stratosphere. That's a pretty ugly end game. And so I think when you think about it, these kind of sunlight reflection methods are, it's like morphine for the cancer patient. It doesn't solve the underlying problem, but may provide some symptomatic relief.
And David Winnicoff, also echoing what Craig Miller was saying a little while ago, solar engineering models might cool the Earth, but doesn't do anything about ocean acidification, for example.
Right. I mean, these techniques address certain pieces, certain symptoms, and I think we can't look to any of these as a solution or even being possible to provide a solution. They're different pieces of the equation, and the ocean acidification piece, which Ken has looked at a bit and others, is a serious problem that SRM would not address.
And let me go back to you, Craig Miller. I mean, consensus in deploying is pretty unlikely if we're talking globally. I mean, the Russians wanted to have more about geoengineering in this report, and they got overruled. I mean, as I said earlier, they want more of Ukraine, too, but that's another story. But, I mean, the sense is that it's like getting, you know, the United Nations Security Council to agree.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's one of the problems with the whole idea of this, is that getting everybody to agree on it, on something that could have, you know, trans-border impacts, you know, is going to be very difficult. And another problem is, what happens if you have to stop for some reason? As Ken pointed out, now you have, if you just keep putting these carbon emissions into the atmosphere, now you have all these emissions out there. And if you ever stop for whatever reason, things could change very rapidly, catastrophically. In fact, there's an interesting recent report in which they tried to model that, and they concluded that this 2 degrees of warming that we're trying to hold the Earth to could happen in about 10 years if they – or actually, I think it was 20 years, 10 to 20 years, you know, if we suddenly stopped mitigating. Might also be useful to point out that we're all, because you mentioned about tinkering with nature, we're already tinkering with nature in kind of a big way just by putting these greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And we really don't know the impacts, the full impacts of that either.
Isn't there international law now that disallows any testing in the open atmosphere?
Testing of geoengineering?
Yeah, the kind
I'm not
of thing
sure
we're talking
can,
about
you know,
here.
I
can?
Not that I'm aware of.
No, not directly. That's one of the serious concerns about even doing research or thinking about deployment is there are huge gaps in the current regulatory architecture, both at the international level and the national level. And so one of the urgencies, I think, around the discussion and one of the points I've been trying to make and others have made is whereas research is probably important to start doing it, at least on a small scale, it can't go on without robust governance architectures. And so that has to happen simultaneously at the very least.
Putting sulfur into the air, though, I don't know, you know, just the thought of that makes me recoil. I mean, and probably most people feel the same way, Ken Caldera.
To return to this issue of the international reaction to this, it might be against the law for Russia to take Crimea, but nobody's really willing to go to war over it. And so if China or Russia or somebody started to put spraying some aerosols in the stratosphere, we might not like it, but would we really be ready to go to war with these great powers? And so while international law is really important, I think political power is also important. The sulfur is one of the gases that's being thought of to spray in the stratosphere, and that's obviously fire and brimstone has bad connotations. Nobody likes it, but the amounts relative to what's currently coming out of power plants is small, but of course nobody really wants to spray.
Sartre,
more.
Right, said you make your own hell, right? So
no, he said hell is other people.
Oh, okay.
And no exit. There's also, though, these computer models, David Winnikoff, which seem to be, I mean, they're talking about preserving the Arctic ecosystem by deploying, and they feel that they have computer models ready to do that, don't they?
Well, Ken can probably speak better to that, but I think that the models, there are some initial indications, but there have been other models that have showed that there may be adverse impacts on large weather systems like the effects on the monsoon. Ken, didn't you have a model that looked at that?
Yeah, Ken, you want to weigh in here? Please.
The models project that sending some sunlight away from the Earth can reduce most of the climate change for most people most of the time, but there always will be some people that will be worse off. But overall, the model suggests that maybe 90% of the temperature changes and 70% of the precipitations can be offset. But that doesn't mean that there won't be some people who will have less rain to grow their crops, and you know that could create tensions and political problems and so on.
Speaking about 90% and the like, I think you've said you're 60% on board as far as geoengineering. What's the 40%
yeah,
that's keeping
well,
you?
I mean, there's a big spectrum here of you know political opinion, and you know on one side it's like oh you're tampering with Mother Nature, and it's just evil to even be thinking about this. And on the other side, it's so methane might pour out of the Arctic, and we need to deploy it today. And so different people fall at different places along here. And me, you know, as long as we're still building coal-fired power plants and gas plants and building more and more things, dumping CO2 into the atmosphere, it doesn't seem right to me to start dumping aerosols in the atmosphere at the same time. And so I think these things should be researched. I'm talking on the solar side, but that it's as long as we're still making the problem worse, we should, you know, in other words, we shouldn't be taking that morphine for the cancer if we're still smoking cigarettes. Let's quit smoking cigarettes first, and then we can think about taking the morphine.
There's also a lot of political risks. I mean, you know, I think that's implicit here.
Yeah, although one of the things that I've found in speaking, and it's been backed up by social science studies, is that you know, environmentalists, and I consider myself one, don't like the idea of spraying sulfur in the stratosphere. And so when the models you know, I'm arguing that we need to stop dumping carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. But when these same models say, well, look, spraying sulfur in the stratosphere would basically work, it shows people that, look, scientists aren't just cooking up the models to give whatever answer they want, that even things they don't like, the models say, would work. And my fear is that, well, the world's a lot more complicated than our models. And in the same way that cane toads took over in Australia and created all kinds of problems where they were introduced to eat the pest on the sugar cane, that, you know, we could make bigger problems in trying to solve the global warming problem in this way.
And again, Ken Caldera is climate scientist with the Carnegie Institution for Science's Department of Global Exchange at Stanford. And Craig Miller is our science editor here at KQED. What about investing more in biofuels, Craig?
That's one of the recommendations, actually, in the report, that this is an area that holds a lot of promise, but it also has problems of its own. You remember when there was a mass a rush into ethanol and the impacts that it had on corn prices and corn availability all over the world. Basically, all the corn got sucked up, you know, or much of it into ethanol production, and it actually created food and livestock feed shortages. So, again, you know, every area has its unintended consequences, and also on the biofuels front, it seems to me to be an area of renewable energy that has maybe in some ways the furthest to go. Maybe we just haven't been putting enough into it. I don't know.
You, David Winnikoff, shaking your head in agreement on that?
Well, I think we do have a long way to go. I think the best, most efficient examples are coming out of Brazil and the use of sugarcane. We don't have efficient enough systems, and there's been a lot of promise. There's some investment in second and third generation biofuels with crops that are very efficient photosynthesizers. And so I think, and there's the people are proposing maybe using algae and growing them efficiently in tanks. But in general, I think we are ways off.
Ken Caldera.
The new element in this report in discussing biofuels is this idea of using the biofuels to generate electricity and then capture that carbon dioxide from the power plant and inject that carbon dioxide underground. And so this way you have the plants pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere. You're using biofuels instead of fossil fuels, and then you're putting that carbon in the ground. So you both substitute for fossil fuels and you withdraw CO2 from the atmosphere. And the main problem beyond these land use issues is that it's expensive. And in general, it's typically cheaper to prevent the CO2 from going into the atmosphere in the first place than to try to pull it back out of the atmosphere later.
Talking, if you just joined us, about the new report that was just released. It's been released in parcels and partially, this is the final piece of it, I should say, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, part of the United Nations. And there's going to be an effect of this with respect to the Global Climate Treaty that's set to be done in 2015 and to go in effect in 2020. But the real question we're kind of grappling with is, what about geoengineering and could that cool our warming planet? We certainly welcome your involvement in the program. And if you have questions or comments or simply want to join the conversation, please feel free to do that now, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your phone calls. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, or go to our Facebook page. Ken Caldera with us, climate scientist with the Carnegie Institution for Science's Department of Global Ecology at Stanford. David Winnikoff is Associate Professor of Bioethics and Society with the Department of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management at UC Berkeley. And Craig Miller is Senior Editor of, Science Editor of KQED. And you will be on the program, if you care to be, when we return. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking once again about climate change. A report was released this week by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and it said that it will take very ambitious efforts, a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions up to 70% by 2050, to keep climate change at acceptable or tolerable levels. And the dire predictions have some people asking whether it's time to think about geoengineering, which is an attempt to use large-scale, high-tech methods to cool the planet. And I've been talking about geoengineering, throwing out some examples of it. As I said, there's a whole basketful. Can we go, Ken or David or Craig, to one of you to maybe give us a sense of some of the other things in this toolkit when we talk about geoengineering? David Winnicott?
Well, one idea I think that's gaining a bit of more traction is the idea that we could put up reflective methods on a more local level using brightening of clouds or putting water vapor into the troposphere at a lower level. And the idea is that, well, maybe there won't be political will to do a global stratospheric deployment of sulfuric material, but we could see this developing at more of a local level, maybe deployed selectively in areas of potential tipping points like the Arctic ice shelves and permafrost, or you could see individual countries turning more towards local deployment in order to protect their citizens or protect their agricultural products and so forth.
I also should mention, I interviewed Beth Shapiro, who's in this re-extinction program. They're talking about putting woolly mammoths up in our, well, hairy elephants, really, yeah. But some form of what, at least in the mind's eye, appears to be the hope for the woolly mammoth by some, and they'll be up in the Arctic. Ken Caldera.
Let me just try to list out a few of the proposals. First of all, just let me say that they broadly fall into two categories. One category of proposals involves removing carbon dioxide or other greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. And these, at least the better of them, are less controversial, like planting trees. And the other ideas beyond planting trees, and the most controversial, is probably fertilizing the ocean, as you mentioned before, to take up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And then on the more controversial ones are typically these ideas of reflecting sunlight to space. And there are different ways that this sunlight could be reflected, either aerosols in the stratosphere, little particles high above where jets fly, as we discussed, or as David just mentioned, the whitening of marine clouds, or as David also mentioned, the whitening of roofs or crops or other surfaces. And so the two basic things are either to remove carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases from the atmosphere, which really does address the underlying problem, or the idea of reflecting sunlight, which is kind of a symptomatic relief.
Well, there was also in this report, Craig Miller, something about carbon capturing and storage. I mean, in the IPCC report, something that Al Gore said is a myth.
I think this has been a very interesting sea change. You're right. Al Gore, the great champion of climate policy, did spend a lot of time going around basically characterizing this as a myth perpetrated by the coal industry, you know, to sell the idea of clean coal. He said that it was a myth because the technology was not in place. But now, I mean, you have this august body, the UN climate panel, basically saying we have to do it. We have to find ways that will allow us – I'll get email about this – that will allow us to continue to burn fossil fuels because we have to. And also, by the way, you know, when they talk about renewable energy, they're including nuclear. And many countries are moving away from not renewable, low carbon energy, I should say. They include nuclear in that, the UN panel does. And many countries are moving away from nuclear for obvious reasons.
Because of Fukushima.
Since Fukushima. Yeah. But as a result of that, they're burning more coal. So the thinking now is, I think, that we have to find a way, at least in a transitional way, to be able to burn fossil fuels, but capture the carbon dioxide that's coming out of the out of that process and stick it somewhere, hopefully forever.
Let me go to our callers, and we begin with Arthur. Good morning, Arthur. You're on the air.
Good morning. This is an excellent program. So I think that in terms of eliminating fossil fuels from our transportation network would be a great idea. In particular, we could have a smart grid that will allow the better use of renewables and electric vehicles that are plugged in 20-some-odd hours a day, as most cars are stationary during that period, could provide services to the grid like regulation services and such, and allow for when the wind blows, the cars would get more electricity, and when the wind stops blowing, the cars would slow down in their charging and thereby allow for more renewables. And for carbon capture and storage, it makes more sense in terms of natural gas, and use the carbon dioxide for industrial processes. There's a lot of use for industrial carbon dioxide rather than putting it in the earth. Coal effluent would be too polluting, but natural gas effluent would be much cleaner.
Yeah, Ken Caldera.
Well, to address
thanks for that, Arthur. Yeah.
Yeah, to address the two issues that Arthur raised, that I think he's exactly right, that the dominant view, just to use the sort of jargon of the field of how we might move ahead here, is to electrify the transportation sector and then decarbonize the electricity generation sector. And so anyway, just to affirm what Arthur said, I think on the use of carbon dioxide, we're just producing too much carbon dioxide to use at all. That for each American, we produce 110 pounds of carbon dioxide each day, and there's almost nothing that we use 110 pounds of each day.
Let me thank Arthur for the call and go right to another caller, and that's you, Val. Hi, you're on.
Yes, hi. I recently rented a documentary at my local store, and it was called What on Earth Are They Spraying? And it was talking about chemtrails that are coming out of very large jets, and this is not the contrail that normal jets emit that are ice and go away. These are the very large chemtrails that we often see in the sky that crisscross sort of unusually in the sky, and they last for a long time. They spread out over time. And allegedly, this documentary was saying that this stuff is aerosol aluminum, has some strontium and barium in it, and it's to block the sun. It's some geoengineering that's already going on. So I was wondering if you could comment on that.
A little hesitation here. David Winnikoff, go ahead.
Well, there's no scientific evidence that this is happening or a threat. I think one of the reasons we're seeing some of these theories go around is I think there's a general distrust or lack of trust in government and government institutions. And I think, you know, I think that breeds distrust of all kinds and certain kinds of theories. I think they have, myself, have no credence in terms of fact. But again, I think they have to be recognized or seen as a testament to why building trust in our scientific institutions is absolutely critical if we're going to make good decisions in this arena.
And let me thank the caller and give you a sample of, well, here's one one kind of pro geoengineering email in the midst of a lot of them that are not. So I'll just read the one that's positive first. Dan writes, my preferred geoengineering project is a fleet of floating platforms that would spew fog off the coast of California. This is a two birds with one stone option in that fog both cools the coast and reduces freshwater losses. But we should start experimenting with some geoengineering options ASAP. On the other hand, here's Robert, who says, instead of dealing with the problem, we're always looking to patch it. All one has to do is look what a travesty we've made trying to outdo nature in the Everglades. Deal with the problem, not the symptoms. Geoengineering is not the way to go. It only treats the symptom. We need to take responsibility for our actions and stop trashing our environment. Pat writes, when will humans learn they cannot do better than Mother Nature? We engineered our way into this global warming catastrophe, and we are fools to think we can engineer our way out by employing interventions whose long-term effects on the world's ecosystems is unknown. And Bradley writes on our Facebook page, geoengineering is a horrible idea. History is absolutely rife with actions causing unintended consequences, such as rats in Hawaii, rabbits in Australia, and removing top predators from the food chain. Acting on a global scale will cause global unintended consequences. This is the only world we have. Let's not have a solution that makes things worse. Let's deal with our emissions first. And secondly, engineers are always over-optimistic about what they can do. I should know. I'm an engineer. Brian tweets the following, have humans ever geoengineered an area without causing erosion, invasive species, overpopulation, or pollution? Well, you get the picture here. Yeah, Ken Caldera.
I'm very much in sympathy with these skeptical emails in that, you know, I do think the best thing that we can do is learn to tread lightly on this planet and let nature go its course as much as we possibly can. On the other hand, if you look at the climate model projections for what happens if we don't reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, the tropics become very hot. There's potential for widespread crop failures, which if we don't have the right social institutions in place could lead to widespread famines.
That was in the last part of the IPCC report, yeah.
And we've done climate model simulations that show that at least in the models, if you cool things down, the crops grow better and people could potentially be fed. And so, I mean, this is not a question of physical possibility. We know that we could build enough solar cells or wind turbines and so on to power civilization. But the questions about political an economic feasibility. And, you know, and so the emailers or your audience is right that the right thing to do is to transform our energy system as soon as possible. Unfortunately, we're not doing this. And if our models show that these methods have the potential for avoiding famine, then we should look into them.
Well, you mentioned the political. Let me just read a few more comments to touch on that. Bill writes on our website, when we have Neanderthals in the Senate blocking presidential appointments because those nominees dare to say global warming is real, perhaps it'll be up to the scientists to save us after all. Another listener says, Carter put solar planets on the White House. Reagan took them off, putting us 30 years behind the curve. How disappointing. David asks, it seems like there's interest in the technology to do something about this problem, but the big money interests and the existing energy infrastructure will work very hard to prevent anything from being done. And how do we overturn that? I don't know if either of you would like to address that, but he's right. I mean, there are, you know, considerable, shall we say, interests here when it comes to profit. Let me just read one more. Ben writes, it's great to talk about these possibilities, but it's impossible to think that countries like China and India, which are terribly corrupt, will adhere to any protocol set by the international community. My question, would it not be a better idea to actively prepare for the coming climate change instead of trying to hold it back? Climate change has been an issue since the 70s, and nothing of real substance has been done, so can we really expect things to change? You're nodding your head, David.
I think there's a lot of wisdom in these comments. I think that basically, we know we need to mitigate and reduce carbon, and we know we need to prepare for changes that are certain to come. So adaptation and mitigation are absolutely the central and core challenge of this century. I think the real question is, do we allow ourselves to even explore, begin to do research with the idea that maybe we might want to develop other tools, sort of a broader toolkit in case things go wrong. And I think it's, you know, we should really hesitate before we do that, because I think it is stepping over a certain threshold when we decide to do that. And so I think, just as many of the listeners are bringing up serious points, I think we need dialogue. That's why I'm so thrilled that we're doing the program. I think we need more public dialogue. It's been a kind of taboo subject. And I think we need to find institutions through which we can deliberate on these issues.
Well said. And Craig, what about that question that was tweeted by a listener named Brian? Have humans ever geoengineered an area without causing erosion, invasive species overpopulation, or pollution?
Well, I probably would not be the definitive historical source on that, but I take his point. I think it's a good one. There's very little you can do to the environment without some kind of consequences. I wanted to say that the point that David brought up is an interesting one about adaptation, because I think that's for some in another area of concern, actually, gradual dawning on us that these climate impacts are already happening and that we have to do something to prepare for them. I think all the focus, all is an exaggeration, but much of the focus now is on this idea of resiliency and adaptation and girding, you know, our coastlines and that kind of thing, which is something we absolutely have to do. But I think there's a worry that if the focus is too much on that, then we won't focus enough on getting the emissions down.
Once again, Craig Miller is KQED science editor. And Ed, you're our next caller. Welcome. You're on the air. Oops. We'll go to Ed. Ed, are you there?
Hi. Yeah, this is Ed, Mike.
Ed, yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to put some real scientific figures on this crisis, which is severe, by the way. Every 1 gallon of gasoline you burn in your car, waiting at the Bay Bridge toll or whatever, puts 19.6 pounds of carbon dioxide. You know how much volume that is? Huge volume, several blocks wide. Carbon dioxide is heavier than air. So you have all of this carbon dioxide pretty much closer to the ground, so breathing it all along. Every American, if you add driving, heating, cooling, trucking, cooking, everything, uses between 20 and 30 tons of carbon dioxide every year. Add to that methane gas, which is 86 times as effective in global warming as carbon dioxide, and you add all of the human beings, 7 billion so far plus, and going to go 9 billion, add all of the cows and other animals, we are putting hundreds of millions of pounds, or actually of tons of methane gas, as well as carbon dioxide from breathing every year on the atmosphere, and yet we are waiting. What are we waiting for? This is definitely a very, very critical crisis which will take us down it will take us down soon. I don't think even really there is a real solution to the problem.
Let me jump in here because you've given a lot of figures, and you know some of this is. I mean, essentially, when you break it down that way, it sounds even more ominous. And yet, you know, he's got a point, Greg Miller.
Well, he says, what are we waiting for? And I'm afraid the answer is we're waiting to find the money in many ways, you know, to really address the problem, because just about all of these things we're talking about are going to be hugely expensive. The adaptation side, certainly, billions of dollars, you know.
And yet the report says, you know, it's not as bad as on the affordability side as perhaps many of us.
Well, not as bad as a relative kind of concept. It's still going to be hugely expensive, yeah. No matter what we do.
Want to add something, Ken Caldera?
I used to think that this problem was mostly about climate crisis and potential for climate catastrophe. And now I'm thinking of it more as a crisis in human institutions and our social and political institutions, in that, you know, we know what we need to do. We need to transform our energy system, but our political institutions are unable to do this. And if you think of my worst case scenario before, where there's famines throughout the tropics, there's enough food in this planet. And so if we had good human institutions, we could share the food and no one would have to go hungry. And so if we deploy a geoengineering system, or if society deploys a geoengineering system at some point, it's not just a climate crisis. It's a failure of human institutions.
It's also analogous in some ways to genetically modified food. I mean, a lot of people feel it's tinkering and it's bad and so forth. And yet there are those advocates who say, you know, can feed the world, even though Zimbabwe didn't want to take the food. But, you know, I mean, the point is in some ways analogous. Let me get some more callers on here. Here's Michael. You're on, Michael. Hi.
Hi, Michael. I'd like to just go back to a topic that was brought up about 20 minutes ago. First of all, this is about chemtrails. The word hasn't been mentioned. Global engineering synonymous with chemtrails. And I find that the scientific community is in stunning denial of the scientific evidence. And I heard just now that there's no evidence. That's wrong. That's not true. And there's a lot of disinformation coming from the establishment about this so-called conspiracy. It's actually fact, not conspiracy. People like Dane Wigington, Clifford Carnicum of the Carnicum Institute have done the analysis. We've got nanoparticles of aluminum dioxide, barium strontium, and a whole bunch of other stuff being dispersed into the environment, coming down, and we're breathing it. And the effects are tangible and measurable. So I would like to just suggest this is the taboo subject. It is not being talked about. And it's not being talked about in this very comfortable conversation over the last year.
Ken Caldera wants to talk about it.
Yeah, I think if you just Google chemtrails on the web, you'll find it's talked about quite a bit. But where it's not talked about is in the quality scientific literature. Scientists make their careers by showing that the mainstream is wrong. And so if a scientist could really show that there was a secret spraying program, you know, where there are right now, there's thousands of scientists studying aerosols in the atmosphere and studying contrails and other cloud forms. And if one of them could show that there were chemicals being sprayed and responsible for these clouds, they could get it published in major journals like Nature and Science, and they would become famous scientists that would be in high demand from every university in the world. And so you have to suggest that all of these thousands of scientists are somehow in a conspiracy to keep this secret. It's just not plausible.
I'm getting a lot of responses on this, I must say, in addition to this call from Michael. I'm looking at a web comment here from Chris. It says, you all speak of the potential for spraying the atmosphere to reflect the sun. Does anyone not think this is already happening? Every day I look, I see planes spraying the skies.
Yeah, I mean, this has been going on for some time, and this theory's been around since at least 1996. And the idea that, I can believe that Dick Cheney would have a secret program to kidnap and torture people, but the idea that Dick Cheney is going to have a secret program to protect us from climate change, it doesn't pass the basic test of plausibility.
What about, and I'm reading another web comment from a listener named Wendy, because this often comes up. She asks, what do the experts think about ice 9/11 and artificial ice that could be broadly deployed to reflect heat in the Arctic?
I have a postdoc working with me that's doing computer model simulations of this right now. The idea is to whiten the surface of the ocean in the Arctic and get sea ice to grow. And you know, it's a, I think, a theoretical possibility. I know I'm going to get some people angry here, but it's, I think it's a theoretical possibility. But in terms of practical, the idea that you're going to take thousands or millions of square kilometers or of the Arctic and whiten it and regrow the ice just seems to me implausible. And also our model simulations show that it doesn't really help in preserving the methane or anything anyway. I think it's a theoretical possibility, but not particularly plausible.
Let me go actually to a few more comments from the web and from your emails, from listeners' emails. Scott writes, Daryl Steinberg, Senate President of California, just withdrew his proposal for a carbon tax. Robert F. Kennedy, in his book Crimes Against Nature, says the free market is a good system. We should try it sometime. If we had a carbon tax, we would have a solution. Another listener writes, please talk about the more meaningful recommendations of the IPCC report using known technologies like renewables and EVs and zero-emission buildings to transition off fossil fuels. Why are we even talking about this pie-in-the-sky stuff? Well, we're talking about it because maybe, at least in some minds, the way out, or at least a way out. But, Craig, you gave us a pretty good thumbnail sketch. You want to add anything to that in terms of traditional ways out?
Every sector has to be addressed. Transportation is huge, you know, in California. It's half, you know, the greenhouse gas emissions. Buildings are an enormous part of it. These are going to be big challenges, too, because, well, when you talk about buildings, so many of them are already built. It's very easy to design and build, put up a new building that is, you know, a net zero energy, you know, it maybe produces its own energy and is very green. But the problem is that the built environment, as it already exists, is so enormous, and retrofitting all of that would be a very big job. But all of these sectors have to be addressed.
Including something that comes up. Jillian says, I read once that if we all started using light-colored tiles, shingles on our roof, it would significantly help with cooling. That's true to an extent, I think, isn't it?
Little bits help a little bit.
Yeah, well, that's the whole point. I think that's what Craig is emphasizing. You need every little bit we can. But here's a tweet. Let me go to you on this, David Winnikoff, from Lisa, who writes, seems pretty obvious to thousands of us that solar radiation management is in full-scale operation. Please address that objectively. I am getting aluminum, barium, and strontium consistently in my rainwater and pond tests. That's consistent with solar radiation management patents.
I think, again, I would echo what Ken said. I think we have a large number of scientists studying the atmosphere and these kinds of formations, and there's all kinds of benefits that would accrue to individual scientists for turning up these kinds of things. And while I don't dismiss the idea that there are pollution in the environment coming from different kinds of sources, I personally can't give credence to these particular theories.
Ken Kilder.
Well, just to me, this shows the kind of tragedy that comes from having secret wars and secret NSA operations and things like that, because people can no longer trust the government. And so, you know, if you have a friend who tells you chemtrails is real, that, you know, and you trust your friend, you know, we believe things. We don't test everything for ourselves. And then when you have a history of government lying, that, you know, you leave citizens in a point where there's nobody, you know, you don't know where to trust. And
I think government trust is part of it. I think we have to do a whole program on conspiracy theories, so we haven't in a long time. In the meantime, let me get another caller on here, and that's you, Michael, from Stanford. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to ask the experts about, the geoengineering experts, about how much certainty there is about the effects on rainfall. I mean, we live in California. We're living through a multi-year drought. Rainfall, changes in rainfall might be the most significant thing that anything we do to the atmosphere might produce. And I'm just wondering how much certainty or uncertainty there is about precipitation and how it might change if we were to try this sort of thing.
Well, first of all, there is a link between climate change and drought to some extent, at least so I've been reading. Not necessarily all that empirically proven, but at least so it's been hypothesized. But what about in terms of geoengineering again? Ken Caldera?
Whether it's greenhouse gases or artificially introduced aerosols, the temperature effects are relatively easy to predict, because more or less if you put greenhouse gases, every place is going to heat up, and if you block some sunlight, every place will cool. But whereas the rainfall is much more difficult, because some places get drier and some gets wetter and complex patterns. And so I mean, the models agree on overall trends, but disagree on what is predicted for different regions and on the magnitudes. And so I would take the models to indicate our best guess of what is likely to happen. But, I wouldn't take the quantitative results for the precipitation changes very seriously at a regional level.
You going to add, David?
No, I just wanted to – can I go back to a comment you made about linking geoengineering with genetically modified organisms because
– Analogy.
Yeah, analogy. Sorry. I think it's apt in the sense that there are strong objections on the basis of a disruption to the natural world and hubris, as well as debates about the potential consequences, risks, and benefits. And I think one of the mistakes we made as a society around GM crops is we didn't have trusted institutions in the beginning to vet the relevant information. In this country, we went straight forward with our existing regulatory system. And I think as a result, people didn't have trust in the technologies. So I think moving forward with geoengineering, I really think what we need is a high-level body, a kind of independent knowledge broker body that actually involves scientists, but also environmental groups, a few citizens from different perspectives to kind of vet the information and to promote discussion in a reasonable way with the public.
With different interests. And Ken Caldera, we've got seconds left here, but go ahead.
Just imagine that somebody started geoengineering and then California went into a few years of drought. The facts of the matter of whether the geoengineering caused the drought or not is almost irrelevant because people will blame the drought on the geoengineering.
Well, on that note, let me do the opposite of blame and thank you all for a very informative and illuminating hour. Ken Caldera, again, is at Stanford as a climate scientist. David Winikoff is at UC Berkeley in the Department of Environmental Science, Policy and Management. And Craig Miller is senior editor at KQED. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. We're produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer Amanda Stupai. And our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.